Historical What Ifs. Historical What Ifs.
History hinges on moments so small they could fit in the palm of your hand, yet their consequences echo through centuries and shape the world we live in today. This is Historical What Ifs, where we explore the alternate timelines that could have emerged from a single different decision, a missed opportunity, or a stroke of luck that went the other way. Today's episode examines one of those pivotal moments and traces the extraordinary chain of events that might have followed if history had taken just one small turn in a different direction. Welcome to Historical What Ifs, Reimagining Pivotal Moments.
We often talk about the people who changed the world, but what about the absence of such a person? What if the single most influential military commander in ancient history simply wasn't?
It's a staggering thought, isn't it? A void where a colossus once stood. And that's exactly what we're tackling today in our episode, The Unseen Colossus, Greece Without Alexander the Great.
This topic has always fascinated me personally because of the cultural ripple effect. We take the spread of Hellenistic culture for granted. The art, the philosophy, the language that stretched from Greece to the borders of India. It's the foundation of so much. But without Alexander, does any of that happen?
Yeah. And for me, it's the raw power dynamics. His father, Philip II, built this perfect Macedonian war machine. Alexander inherited it and aimed it like a spear at the heart of the Persian Empire. If he never takes the throne, where does all that military energy go? Does it just collapse? Does Macedon turn on itself?
Or does the Achaemenid Empire, the superpower of its day, get a new lease on life? Does it reassert its dominance over the Greek world? The entire map, the entire balance of power is suddenly fluid.
It's a cascade of questions. We'll be exploring the potential fates of Athens and Sparta, the trajectory of the Persian Empire, and the very lines on the map of the ancient world. It's a journey into a past that could have been profoundly different.
So the question we're posing today is a big one. How would the complete absence of this one legendary figure have fundamentally reshaped not just his time, but all of history that followed?
So, let's start right at the flashpoint. The year is 336 BCE. Philip II is assassinated. In our history, the succession is chaotic but swift. Alexander, charismatic, proven in battle, and ruthless, secures the throne. But in this timeline, he doesn't exist. So, who steps up?
Oh, that's a power vacuum of epic proportions. Because the obvious heir is his other son, Philip Arrhidaeus.
Who, by all contemporary accounts, was, let's say, not viewed as a capable ruler. Whether due to a genuine intellectual disability or the result of court intrigue, he just wasn't seen as having the capacity to lead.
Right. And you have to imagine the scene in the Macedonian court. It's filled with these powerful, ambitious, hardened generals. Men like Antipater, Parmenion. They've spent their entire lives fighting alongside Philip to build this empire. Are they going to just hand the keys to the kingdom over to Arrhidaeus?
No chance. Not a chance. The loyalty of the Macedonian army was personal. It was to Philip, and then it was transferred through sheer force of will and ability to Alexander. Arrhidaeus can't command that.
So that perfect war machine you mentioned, it immediately turns on itself. It becomes a contest. Who can claim the regency? Who can manipulate Arrhidaeus? It's the wars of the Diadochi, the successors, but happening 20 years earlier and without the empire to fight over.
They're fighting over Macedon and Greece itself. And all that wealth Philip had consolidated from the mines at Pangaeum, the resources he'd stockpiled for the Persian invasion, all of it gets burned up in a brutal civil war.
Exactly. The grand project, the invasion of Asia, dies on the vine. It's not even a consideration. The entire focus shifts inward. Which means, across the Aegean, in Persia, the political calculus changes overnight.
For Darius III, it's an unbelievable stroke of luck. He's just come to the throne himself. He's dealing with instability, particularly in Egypt. And this existential threat that's been building on his western flank for a decade just dissolves.
It's more than luck. It's a strategic reset. He no longer has to divert massive resources and his best troops to Anatolia to watch the Macedonians. He can turn his attention to the satraps, who are getting a little too independent. He can consolidate his own power.
Do you think he does, though? I mean, was the Achaemenid Empire fundamentally sound and just happened to run into the buzzsaw that was Alexander? Or was it an institution already in decline, and Alexander was simply the one who pushed it over?
That is the million-drachma question, isn't it? I tend to believe it had more resilience than we give it credit for. Empires of that scale always have internal stresses. But Darius now has the time and the resources to manage them without a foreign invasion distracting him. Maybe he puts down the Egyptian revolt for good. Maybe he strengthens his borders in the east.
So, the entire Hellenistic age, this fusion of Greek and Persian culture that Alexander's conquests initiated, it just doesn't happen. The cultural and political barrier between East and West, if anything, becomes harder, more defined.
It has to. Think of the coinage, for example. Alexander's coins were this incredible piece of propaganda. You have the Greek hero Heracles on one side and a depiction of Zeus on the other that is deliberately modeled on the Persian depiction of Baltars.
A statement of intent. I am the ruler of both.
Without him, that statement is never made. Persia remains Persian under the Achaemenids. And Greece, well, Greece is likely a chaotic backwater dominated by whatever Macedonian warlord comes out on top of their bloody civil war. The entire center of gravity of the ancient world remains firmly planted in Babylon, not Alexandria, a city that, of course, would never even be founded.
And that loss of Alexandria is something I can't quite get my head around. It's not just losing a city on a map. You're talking about losing the intellectual engine of the ancient world for centuries.
The lighthouse, the great library, all of it, gone before it was ever conceived. It becomes a patch of sand on the Egyptian coast.
Think about the sheer concentration of knowledge that was gathered there. It was the first truly globalist project in a way. They were trying to collect all the world's learning, Greek, Egyptian, Persian, even whispers from India, under one roof. Without Alexander's impulse to fuse those worlds, who has the vision to even attempt that?
Nobody. The vision itself is the key, because the resources existed elsewhere. Babylon had immense intellectual capital. But the idea of Alexandria, the founding principle, was to create a melting pot. It was designed to be a nexus for trade, yes, but also for ideas. A place where a Greek-speaking scholar could debate with a Babylonian astronomer.
And that cross-pollination is what drives innovation. You look at someone like Eratosthenes, who calculated the circumference of the Earth with stunning accuracy. He was the head of the library at Alexandria. His entire worldview, the very data he was working from, was shaped by the reports and maps coming from Alexander's campaigns and his successors.
So, without that, does that leap in geographic and astronomical understanding just not happen? Or does it happen 1,000 years later?
I think it has to be delayed, significantly. Because you lose the impetus. The world remains compartmentalized. The Greeks have a sense of their world, the Persians have a sense of theirs, but that grand unified vision that Alexander's conquests provided, a single map stretching from the Danube to the Indus, that's gone.
But does knowledge stagnate, or does it just evolve differently? I mean, Persian astronomy was incredibly advanced. Indian mathematics was on its own unique trajectory. Maybe, instead of a single Hellenized synthesis, you get 3 or 4 distinct, powerful intellectual traditions that develop in parallel without ever really speaking to each other.
That's an interesting thought. A more fractured intellectual landscape. You wouldn't get the Koine Greek language becoming the lingua franca of the educated world, for example.
No. which means a scholar in Athens can't easily read a text from a peer and say, Seleucia, which also wouldn't exist, of course. That ease of communication, the very thing that accelerated scientific progress, vanishes.
And it's not just the big-ticket items like the library. The input text mentions the sheer number of cities he founded. Most were initially just garrisons, military outposts along trade routes. But a century later, they were thriving cultural centers. Little pockets of Greek culture deep in Asia.
So you're losing the entire network. The Silk Road, as we'd later know it, develops in a completely different way. Because those nodes, those Hellenistic cities, aren't there to secure the routes and facilitate that cultural and economic exchange.
Right. And that creates a much harder border between East and West. A stronger, more consolidated Persia on one side, and on the other, a squabbling, divided Greek world. Which brings up a fascinating question: into what kind of world does Rome eventually expand?
Ooh, now that changes everything. They don't encounter a series of declining Hellenistic successor kingdoms that they can pick off one by one. They'd run headfirst into a still vibrant Achaemenid Persian Empire. That is a completely different fight.
A completely different fight is an understatement. I mean, think about Rome's defining conflict, the Punic Wars. That was an existential struggle against Carthage that forged the Republic. But Persia is an empire on a scale they can't even conceive of yet. The manpower, the wealth, it's a different order of magnitude.
Yeah, could the manipular legion, so effective against phalanxes and tribal warbands, even function effectively against the combined arms approach of Persia? The cataphracts, the horse archers, the sheer depth of their territory. Rome might just break against that wall.
Or more likely, they never even try. The Senate, pragmatic as it was, might look east and just say, no, that is a fight we cannot win. And so they focus entirely westward. They consolidate Gaul, Hispania, maybe push into Britannia and Germania earlier and harder.
And the Mediterranean becomes a hard border, a line in the sea. On one side, a Latin, Roman-dominated west. On the other, a Persian, Zoroastrian-dominated east. There's no middle ground. No Greco-Roman Egypt. No Syria. No Judea under Roman control.
And if Judea isn't under Roman control, my goodness, the entire context for the birth of Christianity just evaporates. It would emerge, if it emerges at all, in a province of the Persian Empire. How does that change its theology, its spread, its relationship with Judaism?
You're rewriting the next 2,000 years. That single shift is almost too big to contemplate. It really brings us back to the central theme of our whole discussion, doesn't it?
It does. For me, the whole exercise reveals how Alexander, for all his tyranny and bloodshed, was the great connector. He smashed these two worlds together, and in the chaos of that collision, a new world was born. Without him, you don't get the collision. You just have these two massive separate continental plates grinding against each other for centuries.
And I think that's where our perspectives have been so interesting. You see that grand geopolitical schism, the clash of empires, and I keep getting pulled back to the smaller, but maybe more profound losses. The art, for instance, that fusion of Greek and Indian styles in Gandhara that gave us the first human-form statues of the Buddha. That's gone. A whole artistic and religious tradition never comes to be.
It all just develops in isolation. It's a less connected world. And I suppose the ultimate, unanswerable question is whether that's a better or worse world. It's impossible to say, but it's hard not to feel a sense of loss for the one we know, for the incredible, chaotic, brilliant fusion that Alexander unleashed.
See, and I wonder if loss is the right word, or if it's just different. A world with a more robust, long-lasting Persian civilization, a more self-contained Roman one, and intellectual traditions that grew in parallel rather than being blended. It's a less interconnected world, certainly, but maybe a more culturally distinct one. It's a staggering reminder that history isn't inevitable. It's made. And it can be unmade by a single absence. The butterfly effect of history reminds us that the world we know today is just one of countless possibilities, shaped by moments of chance, choice, and consequence that could have easily gone another way. This has been Historical What Ifs, where every episode reveals how fragile our timeline really is, and how different decisions by our ancestors might have created an entirely different present. Understanding these alternate possibilities doesn't just satisfy our curiosity. It helps us appreciate how remarkable it is that we ended up in this particular version of history.